Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Thursday, August 30, 2018. Rebel leader Riek Machar and other opposition groups have just signed a revitalized peace deal in Khartoum.
We agree in the process. We put our solution. And we hope that the government also in Juba will look into it, because we don't want to sign an agreement and we'll go back to the war again.
And friends of Peter Bier Ajak say they will continue to demand for his release a month after he was detained.
I think the most important thing to note is, even though Peter is detained, and you know, I know him personally, you know, I don't have many friends on the ground in South Sudan, but knowing that this is a larger struggle, which is a larger issue within the South Sudanese government of detaining vocal political opposition.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Rebel leader Riek Machar and other opposition leaders, including the South Sudan Opposition Alliance and the former detainees, have signed a revitalized peace agreement in the Sudanese capital Khartoum this past hour. The group had initially expressed reservation about the revitalized 2015 peace deal. This past hour, the SPLM-IO deputy spokesperson confirmed that rebel leader Riek Machar and other opposition party leaders worked on a draft of their reservations and conditions that was to be handed over to the IGAD mediation team before they could sign the deal. SPLM-IO and other South Sudanese opposition parties refused to sign the deal earlier this week, citing a number of contentious issues, including the number of states and their boundaries during the pre-transitional period. Peter Manoa Gatkwath says after a series of meetings among the opposition parties and the Sudanese mediation team, they have agreed to sign the deal after receiving confirmation from the Sudanese President Omar Hassan al-Bashir that their conditions and reservations will be addressed by the IGAD summit. SPLM-IO spokesman Manoa Peter Gatkwath says the ceremony will take place in Khartoum this evening.
Both parties will sign this document, but we'll put our condition also to sign the document regarding the mechanism of decision-making in the government, also issues related to mandate of the UN, the forces that will guarantee the peace agreement, also about the National Constitutional Conference-making process.
He says their conditions will be handed over to the Sudanese mediation, which is expected to turn those concerns to the IGAD heads of states. Manoa says he remains hopeful that the government and other peace partners will cooperate with them and resolve the outstanding issues once and for all.
We agree in the process. We put our solution. And we hope that the government also in Juba will look into it, because we don't want to sign an agreement and we'll go back to the war again.
The Sudanese mediation team says if all the parties sign the peace deal, a workshop on the pre-transitional security arrangement will take place in the coming 2 days, which will include the implementation matrix. That report was prepared by Michael Atit in the Sudanese capital, Khartoum. Friends of the detained South Sudanese activist Peter Bier Ajak have formed a campaign called Free Peter Bier Campaign. The campaign has passed its one-month mark this week. Bier's friends say the work to pressure the South Sudanese officials to release the young activist has not slowed down. Aaron Spencer, a friend of Peter Bier Ajak, who heads the South Sudan Young Leaders Forum, tells Ayen Bior that his former university classmate was given opportunity to see his family in prison, but the duration of his imprisonment remains to be seen.
How long that will be, we don't really know, but we're preparing for long term. You know, we've definitely moved into the 1 month, beyond the 1 month planning. And we're looking at 6 months, 1 year, even possibly sustaining this movement and what it takes to sustain that. I think the most important thing to note is, even though Peter is detained, and you know, I know him personally, you know, I don't have many friends on the ground in South Sudan, But knowing that this is a larger struggle, this is a larger issue within the South Sudanese government of detaining vocal political opposition, nonviolent political opposition. These are men of peace, women of peace who are seeking to better their country. They've been called to do that. And so we're making sure that everyone understands that there are other political prisoners that are being held, and that Peter is just one of the most recent in many that has happened over the last few years.
Have you spoken to his family?
I have. I've spoken with some of his family members over the last couple of weeks, for sure, yeah.
What are their feelings? Have you spoken to them recently, and how are they coping with the arrest?
Sure. So I speak with them fairly infrequently on the phone. You know, there's a lot of traveling, and, you know, we want to maintain safety for them as well, so there's a lot of messaging. Understandably, the family is upset. You know, their husband, their brother, their son has been taken a prisoner for seemingly nefarious reasons, for unknown reasons, as to why he was held or is being held. So, you know, family is understandably distraught. They want their father back. They want their husband back. So the sentiment there is kind of heavy. You know, it's very complicated. But the one thing that they understand is this is part of a larger issue in the country, and they are working to ensure Peter's release, his safe release, as well as the release of other detainees. I know that Peter is in, you know, good health, unharmed, because a family member has been to visit him and seen him. You know, he's had a few visits, including some with his wife. And so we do know that he is physically well, and we're hoping he stays that way.
The Free Peter Biar campaign online has gone viral. There's a campaign that has garnered over 64,000 signatures. We've seen U.S. senators call on the South Sudanese government to release him. What do you think it is about this particular arrest that has caused so much action online?
I think that what makes Peter's arrest unique is the fact that he has friends and co-workers around the world. You know, at the Harvard Kennedy School, at LaSalle University, where he and I met, and at the University of Cambridge, you know, that's where he forged some of these networks, where people, we were kind of called to action, and we sprung into action almost immediately after hearing the news.
And what are the next steps? What are your plans for the future?
The first thing that we have coming up, the first big thing we're pushing, is we have a peaceful demonstration occurring in Washington, D.C. on September 7th. That will be happening in the Georgetown neighborhood. It will be a peaceful march and demonstration, leading in a small and ending in a small rally near the South Sudanese embassy in Washington, D.C.
That was Aaron Spence, a member of the Free Peter Biar campaign. He was speaking to Ian Bior from Phoenix, Arizona. 3 senior fire brigade officers appeared in the Jonglei State High Court in Bor today for allegedly squandering more than 3 million South Sudanese pounds meant for paying salaries of firefighters in Bor town. All the 3 officers denied the charges. Deng Gai Deng reports for VOA from Bor.
The prosecution accuses the 3 officers of misappropriating 3.5 million South Sudanese pounds, which was meant to pay the salaries of 904 fire brigade personnel, also repair to her civil defense forces for the months of November and December last year. The court heard testimony that the money came from the national government in Juba. Instead of paying firefighters their wages, the 3 officers instead pocketed the money. The prosecution told the court that the salaries of the subsequent month were paid. John Deng Dao represented the prosecution in court today.
We received a salary of January and February and March. This year. Okay. Yeah. And we demand salary of November and December that we need from the director of Fire Brigade. We not informed about what happened in this money. But the director who can explain to the court what has happened to the money.
Justice John Yel Aleu is presiding over the case against the 3 fire officials.
Jacob Jok and Colonel David Deng and Mayon Nathaniel. They are being accused under section 351, 352 and 48 Penal Code Act 2008. And when the case is proceed before the courts. We have our procedures that we have to have the prosecutor and his witness and even the documents. After we had the documents, the prosecutor witness and the documents, we reached to the stage that we have to frame the issue or to frame the charges against the accused.
Colonel David Deng, director of the fire brigade in Jonglei State, denies he pocketed the wages of fire department personnel. He says he did not receive money to pay firefighters for the month of November and December in 2017. After listening to both the prosecution and defense, Judge Aliu said he found the suspect, Jacob Jok, and Mayol Nathaniel were simply following orders from their boss, Colonel David Deng.
But we find Jacob Jok and Mayol Nathaniel, there is nothing or there is a ground that to be accused with that. So they are being set free under Section 226, Criminal Procedures Act 2008. And the second accused, Colonel David Deng, has been accused under Section 351. And he replied and he denied. And he said he have his own witness that to verify and to at least whether to make a doubt on the prosecutor case or to prove that these 2 months, month of November, month of December 2017, are not yet been sent from Juba to Jonglei State.
Judge Aliu has adjourned the case until September 13th, when the defense will produce its witnesses in court. Following the judge's ruling, lawyer James Mayan Makir, who represents the accused, says the judge followed the right procedure.
I request from the court as a defense advocate to give us enough time to summon the chairperson of the committee, which called investigation committee. And also, it was adjourned, we were in need of the Commissioner of Civil Defense Force in headquarters to come and clarify exactly to the court the manpower of the Jonglei State, the real budget of the manpower in Jonglei State, the face sheet exactly for those manpowers.
Makir says he is satisfied his client will have time to produce witnesses in court. For VOA News, I am Deng Gaiding in Bor.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, a deadly helicopter crash killed 8 people in Ethiopia. We'll bring that story right after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what stresses you out?
When I have so much to do and I end up procrastinating and leave everything the last minute, I end up being stressed out.
The economy that is really going to its end, we feel like we are finished. The economy is terrible and it's finishing me, it's stressing me.
I get stressed when I don't get my financial needs met.
Insecurity that we are facing here and there.
Too much work stresses me out, and then sometimes boredom stresses me out.
Currently, I study 9 hours in a day, and that stresses me out.
When I have a lot of work in front of me, and also there is someone need also to disturbing me, telling me something also to be added, you know, I feel more stressed.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. There has been a helicopter crash in the neighboring Ethiopia today. 8 people died when a military helicopter crashed in the country's Oromia region, according to the state-affiliated news agency FANA, which says the crash was an accident. FANA says 15 of the dead were members of the country's defense forces. 3 civilians were also killed in the crash. The Ethiopian Addis Standard newspaper reported that the Ethiopian Air Force is investigating the crash, which happened as the aircraft flew from Daridawa to Bishoftu. A British Prime Minister Theresa May wrapped up her three-day tour of Africa by visiting Kenya on Thursday. May's trip is aimed at improving Britain's economic ties to the continent before UK departure from the European Union next year. Mohammed Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
Theresa May is the first British leader to set foot in Kenya, a former British colony since Margaret Thatcher in 1988. In Nairobi Thursday, May pledged to build stronger economic and trade ties with the East African nation.
So as Britain prepares to leave the European Union, we're committed to a smooth transition that ensures continuity in our trading relationship with Kenya, ensuring Kenya retains its duty-free, quota-free access to the UK market, and to building on our strong trade and investment ties to create even more opportunities for our businesses and for our consumers.
May met with President Uhuru Kenyatta at State House to discuss how the two countries can work together on issues of trade and investment, as well as building stability and fighting terrorism in East Africa. Earlier in her trip, May pledged $5.2 billion to support African economies. Kenya is hungry for that kind of foreign investment, which can provide employment and opportunities to its growing population. The head of the Africa Policy Institute, Peter Kagwanja, says Kenya offers huge opportunities to British companies.
I think Britain wants good relations with Kenya as well as a market, an expanding market. Kenya is now almost 50 million people. It is tapping into a larger market of about 250 million people from the Great Lakes to South Sudan to southern Ethiopia to northern Tanzania, and so on. So it's a huge market. It's an epicenter of a huge market in Eastern Africa. And Britain would like to be a competitor in that.
Gerishon Ikiara is an international economic affairs lecturer at the University of Nairobi. He says Britain and Africa need each other.
So therefore, it is to the advantage of both the UK and the African countries to understand each other and see which side of the brand is important for us. How can we have a win-win situation?
May's visit to Kenya wrapped up a three-day trip that included stops in Nigeria and South Africa. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
From Nairobi, we move to Zimbabwe, where Zimbabwe's President Emmerson Mnangagwa reappointed his two deputies to help him deliver his election promises in his new five-year term. Reporter Jose Zanivashi has details.
Retired General Constantino Chiwenga is one of the deputies that were reappointed by Mnangagwa today. He took his oath of office before Justice Luke Malaba this morning.
I, Constantino Kuvea Dominic Nyigazino Chiwenga, swear that as Vice President of the Republic of Zimbabwe, I will be faithful to Zimbabwe and will obey, uphold, and defend the Constitution and all other laws of Zimbabwe, and that I will promote whatever will advance and oppose whatever may harm Zimbabwe.
Chiwenga led the army last year when it forced out President Robert Mugabe, who had led Zimbabwe for 37 years, and placed Mnangagwa in office. Kembo Mohadi, who also served as vice president under Mnangagwa after Mugabe's ouster, also was sworn in Thursday. Nick Mangwana is the ZANU-PF chairman for the UK chapter. He looks ahead.
What's next is parliament has to be sworn in. The president has to announce his pickings for members of his cabinet. What will follow again is the shifting and movement, including recruitment of new permanent secretaries to replace those who have reached the pensionable age and who are leaving.
Mangwana says then some new ambassadors will go out to replace some of the diplomats who returned home before the July 30th polls. Some critics have been skeptical that Mnangagwa and his party will appoint any new individuals to the cabinet. Mangwana, however, says there is a high likelihood there will be new and younger faces.
We have got a young population, and definitely the cabinet and every facet of our economy and establishment should reflect that reality.
Munyara Dzidodo is the editor of Open Parley, an online publication that covers political developments. He says not much will change.
It's the same team, two vice presidents. Nothing has changed, really, except the realization that nothing has changed. This will largely influence what we will likely see with the cabinet, that nothing has changed.
The appointment of cabinet ministers and opening of parliament will be delayed as President Mnangagwa leaves for Beijing Friday for the China-Africa summit. Some members of the opposition worry that over the next 5 years, ZANU-PF will be able to use its two-thirds majority in parliament to amend the constitution. Several ZANU-PF leaders have already indicated they favor raising the minimum age for the president to 55, which would block the leader of the main opposition group, the MDC Alliance, from running for president for years. The man, Nelson Chamisa, is 40 years old. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zinawashe from Harare.
From Harare, we move to Kigali, where Rwanda's government and the UN Refugee Agency today begin issuing national refugee identification cards in Kigali. The UNHCR says these IDs will help more than 172,000 refugees move freely and work instead of relying on food assistance. Daniela Onyita is the UNHCR External Relations Officer in Rwanda. She spoke with reporter Edwin Uimana about the program.
So the current exercise, which is taking place now in Kigali, will affect some 2,700 people residing in Kigali and the neighborhoods. However, the objective is to provide these national refugee ID cards to the rest of the refugee population. We are first starting in urban areas, as we did for the verification exercise. So from Kigali, we'll probably go to Huye, and then we'll continue with the camps. So now the objective is also to continue the rollout of the verification process in the rest of the camps, like Ziba and Mahama. Mahama is due actually to take place in the first quarter of next year.
How will the verification process work, and how long will it take?
The verification exercise was more to have a clearer idea now, few years after they arrived here, to know their status, they to know their address, if they have specific needs, the size of their families, etc. So it's more to better know them and to know that they are still living here in Rwanda.
And how do you do that?
We have teams together. We work together with NIDA. UNHCR works together with NIDA and the immigration, and we have teams roving in the country. Spending 2, 3, 4 weeks, depending on the size of the camp. And this is all done manually. It's also through biometrics. We aim at finishing the whole process by the first quarter of next year.
The Rwanda government say the card will help refugees with access to different public and private services, employability, and to move more freely in the country. Can you explain this more clearly and give us some examples?
So this national identity, refugee identity card, will enable refugees to be considered for the national health system. You know that there are some categorizations. So thanks to the criteria which is already in place for the Rwandan population, we will be able to apply the same together. It's UNHCR and the government of Rwanda. We plan to use the same methods. So to help refugees and ensure that they have a health coverage. Now this applies to education services as well, where we want the refugee children to be enrolled in national schools, in both primary and secondary school. This card will definitely enhance their employability, but of course we need to look at the skills of the refugees and how to enhance the skills and to provide them opportunities to enhance their skills. Mm.
You also say they will be able to move freely.
Yes.
What do you mean by that?
We expect that once we will have also this readable machine for travel documents, they will be able to go outside of Rwanda, to cross borders.
That was Daniela Onyita with the UNHCR. She was speaking with Ijuin Uimana in Kigali. Yeah. Algerian health authorities claim the situation is under control after cholera epidemic in at least four provinces caused more than 60 confirmed cases of the disease and killed at least three people. Edward Iranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
Residents in a village of Tipaza province are drinking water from a spring government officials claim is infected with the cholera virus. But residents protest the spring is safe to drink from and the government analysis is mistaken. A cholera outbreak has been confirmed in Tipaza, Blida, Algiers, and Buira provinces. More than 130 people have been hospitalized with suspected cases of cholera this month, and more than 60 cases were confirmed. At least three people have died, according to Algerian media. Algeria's health minister, Dr. Mokhtar Hezblaoui, recently said health officials have been doing their best to keep on top of the situation. He says since the disease was discovered, the health ministry has devised a strategy to come to grips with it and to stop it from spreading. Dr. Issam Edine Bou Youssef of the El Hadi Fliki Hospital Center, which treats infectious diseases in Algiers, told Al Hora TV hundreds of people have come to the hospital fearing they were suffering from cholera. He says patients must be quarantined and the disease isolated. He stresses his hospital has set up a specialized and isolated wing to treat patients while they recover once the disease has been confirmed. Bou Youssef says many people have been panicking, mistaking stomach ailments for cholera. Local media report consumers are buying up large quantities of mineral water. An old man who lives in the capital, Algiers, tells Al Hora TV he is afraid. He says, cholera is dangerous to me because it has killed and sickened a number of people, and he thinks that a large number of people who live in the area have been hit. Dr. Mohamed Gamari complained to a local TV station the media uncovered the cholera epidemic before the government did. He said doctors in Khazruna, where the disease was first detected, should have sounded the alarm when they noticed the unusual number of diarrhea cases. Pharmacies in Algiers have been selling large quantities of salts to treat diarrhea, while many people have been avoiding fruits and vegetables, which they fear may be contaminated by the cholera virus. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
That's our show for this Thursday. We now take you back to South Sudan with a new peace song by Isaka Number One.
Zaman keli na pulu geni fo wata wa wonu sobera. Zaman keli na rija fakiri kan mushkila de bada minuel. Zaman keli na manesitu nina lisa akwana. Zaman keli na kulu arufu nina yaljuno. Asha ni yalbikore agato mbi nagis. So one di kore, rujal to mon di kalasu. Abo had di kore, iyal to mon di waduro. Jidoza to di kore.
We have been listening to Isaka Number One with his new peace song. I'm John Tanza in Washington. It's good to be back. Thanks for listening, and please join us tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Leshuno nina lisa vishakilu badontana. Ashan mono nina lisa biferigu badontana. Kalamshuno nina lisa bilak badunufustana.